You are listening to an InsightView.eu podcast. InsightView has interviewed Tom Nuttall, The Economist's Berlin bureau chief. Soon, Chancellor Merkel will step down, which raises many unanswered questions about the future of Germany and the European Union. The editor asks Tom about Angela Merkel's performance since she was elected Chancellor in 2005. Also, we talk about what comes next. How will domestic politics and not least foreign policy change with the Green Party as a coalition partner? What about Germany's relationship with China and with the United States?
First, thank you, Tom, for taking part in this podcast. Has Chancellor Merkel left Germany and Europe in a better position today than when she became Chancellor in 2005?
Well, that's a difficult question. It was a long time ago. It was a different world. What would have been the counterfactual? But I think there are several ways in which one can cast a skeptical eye upon Angela Merkel's chancellorship when viewed when you take the long view. I think one of the sort of striking things about Angela Merkel as a chancellor is that it's difficult to imagine that after she steps down later this year, when we look back at what will have been more or less a 16-year chancellorship, it's really difficult to discern any distinguishing features or striking themes, anything that you might call Merkelism. Because really what one sort of trait that has really characterized her time in office has been it's been sort of reaction. You know, she reacts to events. She acts slowly, with great deliberation. She's been a good crisis manager for Germany and of course, often for Europe as well throughout a series of crises. But there's very little of what you might call vision, very few ideas that act as a thread throughout her chancellorship. And this is something that she's often received a lot of criticism for. I think it's also one reason why she's been such a successful politician. But if you think through the range of challenges that Germany is going to face after she leaves, that she will be handing to her successor, from foreign policy to economic policy to European policy, you see that there are a lot of issues that Germany may not be particularly well equipped to handle. And I think one reason for that is that Angela Merkel hasn't been particularly interested in thinking through what future challenges, what structural challenges are confronting Germany. She's been a reactive politician. She's been sort of backwards looking. And this, I think, could potentially leave her successor with one or two problems to think about, possibly quite early.
Let us start with Europe. In the 1980s and the 1990s, Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand successfully managed to keep momentum in the European integration process. What has Mrs. Merkel achieved during her time in office, seen from a European perspective? Also, has she been a uniting or a divisive force?
I think that's not a straightforward question. I mean, Angela Merkel has been the rock at the heart of Europe throughout what has often been a very, very difficult time. So I used to be based in Brussels. I was there for 4 years at a time when the European Union was just bouncing from crisis to crisis. You know, the Eurozone, Greece, refugees, Russia and Ukraine, Brexit, you name it. And at each one of those, you found Germany, you found Angela Merkel at the heart of the response. Now, I think Now when other Europeans are thinking about what comes next and wondering who's going to take over from Mrs. Merkel as Chancellor, you often detect a great feeling of trepidation. You know, we know her, we can count on her. She's there, she's experienced, she's networked, she's been through it all before. And the prospect of losing that kind of rock at the heart of the European Union, I think, leaves a lot of people feeling uneasy. But at the same time, I think, you know, if we go through these crises that that Europe has faced, the actions that Germany took and that the decisions that Angela Merkel made, in many cases, were extremely divisive and difficult, and often, I think, open to some criticism as well. So if you look at the the Eurozone crisis, which really sort of began in 2009, 2010 with Greece, and of course quickly spread to some other troubled countries on the European periphery, to Portugal, to Ireland, Cyprus, and others that we know about. The way that this was handled at the time was to sort of push through a very sort of Germanic idea of austerity, based on the notion that countries got into trouble because they were fiscally incontinent, that they had spent too much, that they had racked up deficits that were too large, and so on. And this model, which led to bailouts being forced on countries who then had to go through extremely punishing regimes of austerity, Greece, of course, being exhibit A, leaving extraordinary scarring behind, extremely high unemployment, very low growth. I think that a generous assessment would say that the jury is still out on whether this was the right approach to handle this issue, which was based in large part on the inability of the Eurozone to build the structures that it needed, the fiscal structures that it needed to correspond to a monetary union. And in the end, actually, the Eurozone crisis was only quelled by the European Central Bank acting with the independence that the treaties afforded it, when Mario Draghi gave his famous speech declaring that he would do whatever it takes to save the euro in the summer of 2012. So that was a pretty divisive approach that Angela and Merkel took back then. Similarly, on refugees, now this is sometimes taken to be the sort of the decisive moment in the Merkel chancellorship in the autumn of 2015, when she took the decision not to close Germany's borders to refugees and other migrants who were traveling towards Germany from Hungary. Now, both that decision and then a decision around 6 months later to strike a deal with Turkey to reduce the flows coming to Europe, this was Germany acting unilaterally without very much consultation with its allies. At the time, I remember in Brussels, there was a lot of frustration with countries who may not necessarily have disagreed with the approach that Germany and that Angela Merkel were taking, but were extremely frustrated at her decision to simply sort of plow ahead unilaterally, not to consult with allies, not to come up with a broader European strategy of how borders were supposed to work, both internal borders inside the Schengen area and the external Schengen frontier, and this decision to simply strike a deal with Turkey without considering what it might mean for the rest of the European Union. And that left a lingering sense of resentment about what a lot of people consider to be a mismatch between German rhetoric, which is all about promoting European unity and commonality in decision-making, and a sort of a harsh reality of what could be German unilateralism. So I think that, you know, the people will remember a figure who they relied upon to act as I say, the rock of stability at the heart of European decision making. But also when it came to the crunch, a series of decisions that actually left behind a lingering sense of sort of resentment and concern at Germany's willingness to go it alone when it came to the actual crunch of decision making. So, you know, I think it will turn out to be a sort of a fairly mixed picture when people look back at Angela Merkel's European legacy.
In Denmark and several other European countries, it seems that we trust Chancellor Merkel. In Germany, however, there are many different political trends on the far right as well as on the far left. This still leaves the question unanswered whether the rest of Europe can trust Germany's political system to do the right thing in the future.
I don't think that other Europeans need to be overly concerned about what is happening at the extreme ends of German politics. I mean, we do now have, as everyone knows, in Germany, an established party on the far right, the AfD, the Alternative for Germany. And in the last federal election in 2017, the AfD did very well. They came in third place, winning a substantial number of seats in the Bundestag. They've been the largest opposition party because the two biggest parties have governed in the Grand Coalition. This, of course, was alarming to a lot of people inside and outside the country for obvious reasons. I think it's in large part can be explained by the fact that the refugee crisis still loomed very large in German politics at the time. And this, of course, was the an issue on which the AfD was very, very happy to take an extremely strident line. Since then, they've fallen back somewhat, particularly in the COVID-19 pandemic. They've tried to sort of carve out a niche for themselves as a kind of anti-lockdown pro-freedom party, and it hasn't really got them anywhere. They haven't been a voice of relevance in the pandemic. And actually, I think if you look at Germany in a European context, then what you find is really that this is, if I can put it this way, it's an extremely normal phenomenon in the sense that there are not very many countries in Europe or Western Europe that don't have a small but established party on the far right with a foothold in parliament. This is now what you have in Germany, and I think at our election that will be held here in the next federal election in September, you can probably expect the AfD to get around 10%. Now, it's not good for a party that is peddling paranoid, xenophobic, anti-democratic lines to have that level of representation, particularly in Germany. And of course, and the other thing that it does at the federal level, but actually in Germany, more importantly at the state level, is that it can complicate the arithmetic of forming governments, because no other party will govern with the AfD. And this has been a particular problem in some states in East Germany, where the AfD does particularly well. But all in all, it doesn't seem to me to be a sign a particular concern or worry. And the same thing goes for Die Linke, a party of the hard left. There is a small but non-trivial possibility that Die Linke could enter the federal government as part of a left-wing coalition with the Greens and the Social Democrats later this year. I don't think that that's likely, but it's not impossible. As I'm sure your listeners will know, opinion polls in Germany now are in extraordinary flux. The governing CDU-CSU has seen what had been a very substantial lead during the COVID-19 pandemic almost entirely evaporate within the last few weeks as Germans become much more concerned about the management of the pandemic. And that's opened up all sorts of possibilities for different sorts of coalitions later this year. One of them is this idea of a left-wing coalition that could see Die Linke enter government. That would cause concern amongst Germany's European and NATO allies, given the line that Die Linke has taken on the EU and NATO. But I think, you know, we're very much in the realm of speculation there. There are all sorts of possibilities. I think this is a pretty slim one, and lots can happen between now and then. Overall, to answer your question, you know, the sort of strongly pro-European, pro-NATO, pro-transatlantic line that that has been at the heart of German policy making, you know, more or less since the foundation of the Federal Republic in 1949, it remains pretty establishment, remains strong in all of the parties that are likely to form part of a governing coalition, with the possible exception of Die Linke that I mentioned. And you see that in all of the candidates who may take over from Angela Merkel as chancellor. So I would say there's not any particular reason for any of Germany's allies in Europe or beyond to worry too much about what's going to happen at the election in September.
It seems highly likely that the Green Party will become part of the next government in Berlin after the September election. How will you describe Bündnis 90, Die Grünen, as the Green Party is called? The party has moved from the left towards the center. Is this just a pragmatic move to gain power? And is this political move supported by the grassroots?
Yes, it is a pragmatic move to gain power, but I'm not sure I wouldn't be so dismissive of that. I think it's a significant development in a party that is now thoroughly part of the German mainstream, that is fully mobilized to join the next government, which, as you say, it almost certainly will after the election in September. And it's one of the most interesting developments that we have in German politics. So the Green Party did not do particularly well at the last election in 2017. And you know, the most important development in polling terms that we've seen since then is the spectacular rise of the Greens, partly but not only at the expense of the Social Democrats, a more traditional centre-left party that is currently the junior coalition party to Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats. The Green Party have not only helped to contain their internal differences, they still exist, but they are not as they're not as problematic for the party as they have been in the past. They have also fleshed out a policy program way beyond the traditional concerns with climate and the environment. They now have an extremely comprehensive set of policies on things like public investment and fiscal policy, on European policy, on foreign policy, and even on security policy, that mean that they would be a formidable governing partner to whoever it is that they are likely to end up in government with, and will strike a very tough line in coalition negotiations after the election. They also, and this is, I think, is crucial, the party has two co-leaders, Robert Habeck and Annalena Baerbock. Both of these people come firmly from what is called the Realo wing, the sort of realist wing, you can call it a centrist, moderate wing of the Green Party, as opposed to the what is also called the Fundi wing, the sort of more fundamentalist ideological wing of the party. Now, that wing is still there inside the party and needs to be reckoned with and needs to be negotiated with sometimes. But the party is pretty unified behind its two leaders. At some point in the next few weeks, in April or May, the pair of them will decide which of them is to lead the party into the election, which of them will be the candidate for the chancellorship. One of the things that I think is key to the success that the Greens have had in the last few years is that this pair, Robert Habeck and Annalena Baerbock, do genuinely seem to be able to work together pretty effectively. They share an office. They share a sort of kind of bureaucratic infrastructure, personnel, and so on. And that means that the Greens have been spared some of the internal squabbles and rows that have stricken them in the past. They also seem to command the support of most of the party behind them, which means that you have a more unified party going into the election that you've had in the past. That doesn't mean that they're going to be entirely sort of insulated from rows when it comes to negotiating a coalition agreement. And one thing that will be at the top of the minds of the Greens when they're in negotiations with whoever their coalition partners are likely to be, is that whatever coalition treaty that they negotiate is going to have to be approved by the grassroots. And that isn't necessarily going to be easy. I think it will depend on who they negotiate with. But, you know, if the base case for a lot of people is still a government of the Conservatives, the CDU, CSU, and the Greens. And if you do have that sort of governing arrangement, then I think one of the trickiest areas, probably the trickiest area for the Greens, will be in the area of military and security policy on things like arms exports or the conditions under which a German government would be prepared to deploy the armed forces. Things like that are going to be very, very sensitive for the grassroots of the Greens, some of the people who would have to approve a coalition treaty. And that means that you might see Green negotiators have to strike a pretty tough line with the Conservatives in order to be able to come up with an agreement that they know will be approved by their own party. And I don't think that the difficulty of that should be underestimated. So you might expect the feelings at Green grassroots to constrain the options that Green negotiators have when they're negotiating that coalition treaty. So that grassroots angle, it still is pretty strong, but I think you're going to see a much more unified Green Party going into coalition negotiations than you have done in the past.
In the last decade, Berlin has pursued a somewhat ambiguous foreign policy regarding China and Russia, which all EU member states do not necessarily share. In many ways, Germany's foreign policy has conflicted with Chancellor Merkel's human decency, which applies not least to China's treatment of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang and Russia's President Putin's international law breach by murdering people abroad. Is there something contradictory in Mrs. Merkel's foreign policy?
China, I think, is has become the biggest foreign policy test for Germany in recent years. And it has undergone a certain evolution. I wouldn't overstate it, but there have been changes there. To put it in context, you have to understand that in the 2000s, the integration of China into the global economy and global supply chains was absolutely central to Germany's own growth model, which, as everybody knows, is led by exports. There was a sort of a marriage of convenience where, as China grew, needed the sort of high-end manufacturing that German companies excel in producing, then you had this sort of perfect synchronicity, and the share of Chinese exports in the share of China in German exports grew at pace. So it was very much in the German interest to ensure that China was folded into the global system. And there's a German saying, Wandel durch Handel. This was a rather sort of self-serving phrase. It means change through trade. The idea being that if you fold China into the global trading system and you ensure the growth of a middle class through economic growth there, then you would naturally see the liberalization of the political system. Now, this is obviously a very nice thing for Germans to be able to tell themselves, because it means that you can have Germans getting richer and China becoming more liberal at the same time. Now, what has happened in the last few years is it's become impossible to sustain this notion. China has not become more liberal. It's become more autocratic. It's become more of a threat to its neighbors and beyond. It's become more of a global player. The human rights abuses at home have become impossible to ignore, and so on and so forth. This has coincided with a shift in the Chinese economic model. As its companies have climbed up the value chain, some of them, in certain sectors at least, have become not a customer for German exporters, but a rival to them. Chinese companies have started to buy up German ones. There was a particular purchase in, I think it was 2017, of a German robotics company that was a real wake-up call for a lot of German industry when they realized that the Chinese were coming to eat their lunch. And so you've seen a change in mindset to a certain extent in German industry about what China represents. At the same time, a lot of German companies still have very, very big bets on Chinese growth, particularly in the crucial car sector. Volkswagen is huge manufacturing facilities in China. Lots of German car exporters still see that their growth in the future is largely going to come from China. So it's a complicated picture. What does this all mean for foreign policy? Well, if you look back, Angela Merkel has made many visits to China throughout her years as Chancellor. If you look back at the speeches that she's made in that time, you find a sort of one common theme, which is the need to ensure that China is not only folded into the global economic model, but that it is part of the global multilateral system. It is part of writing rules on everything from genetics to artificial intelligence, you name it. She's very, very wary of what she and others in Germany are concerned about, an American-led push to sort of divide the world into warring camps, the US and its allies on one side, China and its allies on the other. Angela Merkel doesn't want that. She doesn't want the world to be cleaved like this. But of course, she's leaving office. What does it mean for who's going to follow her? Well, there are some people in the German system, China watchers, who think that Angela Merkel's China policy has basically been rendered out of date by changes in China, and that Germany is going to have to strike a more confrontational line. There are others who think that this approach, they still want to keep faith in multilateralism, as Angela Merkel has done. So that, I think, is going to be one big foreign policy question, probably the biggest foreign policy question for whoever succeeds her. We spoke about the Greens a bit before. The Greens have sort of, it's interesting to watch how they have carved out a certain foreign policy niche in recent years, which on one hand is quite sort of muscular and assertive, very anti-authoritarian, very pro-human rights, sort of anti-Russia, anti-China, where they see cynicism in the governing parties, the CDU and the SPD, a sort of mercantilism, a foreign policy that's driven by commercial interests, they have been able, they see, to take a more idealistic line. And if you do find the Greens in government after September's election, then I think you can see you can expect to see that sort of foreign policy fingerprint, particularly if we have a Green foreign minister, which I think is likely. On the other hand, there will be a question for the Greens, which is, to what extent are you prepared to back up this kind of tough foreign policy line with hard power? Because the Greens have always been particularly skeptical of that. They're skeptical about meeting Germany's commitment to devote 2% of GDP to military spending, its NATO commitment. They're worried about arms exports. There's generally a strong strain of pacifism that runs through the party, particularly at its base. Some will see inconsistency between those traditions in the party and what has become a much more assertive foreign policy line when it comes to authoritarian states like China. So that's one of the threads that will have to be unraveled if we get the Greens in government after the election in September.
Angela Merkel will soon leave politics. Armin Laschet, who shares many of the same views as Mrs. Merkel, has been elected the new party leader, as a majority in the CDU believe the way to gain power is through the center. On the other hand, he is not seen as a strong chancellor candidate. There's talk about Markus Söder, CSU minister president in Bavaria, could be an alternative chancellor candidate. This gained momentum after Merkel failed to support or even criticized Mr. Laschet during an interview with ARD, a public TV station. Is this a possible outcome, and why should Mr. Söder leave a safe Bavaria just to get defeated in the upcoming national election?
So the question of who's going to lead the CDU and its Bavarian sister party, the CSU, into the election in September, who will be the chancellor candidate, is at the top of everyone's minds at the moment. This is basically a question of, is this going to be Armin Laschet, who since January has been the leader of the CDU, Angela Merkel's party, or will it be Markus Söder, who is the leader of the CSU and also the minister president of Bavaria? In general, one would imagine that Mr. Laschet would have the stronger claim. The CDU is the much larger party. His victory in a sort of an internal party election for the party leadership in January ought to have given him momentum just ahead of this decision. The problem is that Mr. Laschet has basically disappointed at every turn since then. The CDU did badly in a pair of state elections a couple of weeks ago. Armin Laschet has been slow to respond to difficulties. He doesn't have much of a public profile. He's not perceived to have performed particularly well during the pandemic. And the contrast between Markus Söder, who's very good at presenting himself as a sort of a man of action, always on TV, has very good at sort of presenting himself as immediately responsive to the needs of voters, also has a very if I can say, sensitive set of political antennae. He's very alert to changes in the political mood. Some might see that as cynical, but it doesn't seem to have done him any harm, because he's much more popular amongst both voters and supporters of the CDU-CSU than Mr. Laschet is. That's why this question remains so open. Now, they have said that they are going to make a decision between Easter and Pentecost at the end of May. It looks increasingly likely that that decision is going to come sooner rather than later. As you said, Angela Merkel issued a criticism of Armin Laschet, as well as some other state leaders, in a TV interview on March the 28th, because Armin Laschet's state, North Rhine-Westphalia, is among several that have deviated from a national agreement to pull a so-called emergency brake on COVID-19 restrictions when caseloads get over a certain number, and that's irritated Angela Merkel. Will that make a huge amount of difference to the decision on who's going to be the candidate? I'm not sure. I think that the money is still probably on Armin Laschet. Markus Söder has always insisted that his place is in Bavaria and not beyond. And I think the only way that this job ends up going to Markus Söder, the only way that he ends up becoming the chancellor candidate for the two parties, is if, in essence, the CDU comes calling to him and says, Mr. Söder, we need you to lead us. We don't think that Armin Laschet is up to the job. And so far, there are a few minor figures in the CDU who have said that, who have said, we think that the best way of ensuring a good result in the election is for Markus Söder to lead us. But actually, for Markus Söder to say that he wants to do this, to actually really to put his name forward, you're going to need to get some much, much bigger names to come out, you know, senior CDU MPs, cabinet ministers, people of that stature. And so far, there's no sign of that happening yet. Now, it could happen because the CDU does appear to be in quite a serious crisis now. Its polling numbers are falling off the cliff. The management of COVID-19 is all over the place. Support for the government's handling of the pandemic is just evaporating. So, you know, it's not at all impossible that you may see some big shifts in the days and the weeks ahead. But right now, there are no substantial signs of a major shift in the mood towards Markus Söder. And I think that that is a necessary condition for him taking the job. No signs of it happening yet. You asked why might he want to do that, given what's happening to the polling numbers. I mean, that's not an unreasonable question. Becoming the minister president of Bavaria, which he did a few years ago, was always considered to be his main ambition. It's a pretty good job. He's very secure in that job. He could be pretty confident that he would be able to lead the CSU into an election victory in Bavaria, their next election in a couple of years' time. Whereas the prospects for the CDU-CSU at national level look much, much more uncertain in September, given what's happened to their opinion polls. On the other hand, leading Germany has clearly got to be a tempting job for a man who has as much ambition as Markus Söder clearly has. Although the CDU-CSU are clearly struggling in the polls, I still think that it's pretty likely that they will be leading the next government and that the candidate that they choose to lead them into the next election will therefore become the chancellor, will take over from Angela Merkel. And I think that that has to be a tempting prospect for Markus Söder if the CDU does come to him and say that they think that they need him to lead him into the next election, that they need him to ensure that they have the strongest election results as possible, then I think he would find it pretty hard to turn that down.
President Biden's foreign policy seems not to have changed much since President Trump left the White House, although the new administration seems more predictable. That said, this means that the squeeze of Europe by the United States and China will probably continue. Therefore, a strong and well-functioning EU is more needed than ever before. Is such an outcome in the pipeline, considering what we have just discussed?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, as we were discussing before, I don't think that it's not really conceivable that any of the possible men or women who could take over from Angela Merkel as chancellor, or any of the possible coalitions that could emerge from the election in September, and there are several possibilities, I don't really think it's conceivable that any of them would seek to bring about a fundamental change in Germany's Europe policy or its relationship to China. I do think it's possible that the Biden administration, as it figures out its own approach to China and how it's going to seek to work with allies, very much including Europe, on China, I think it is possible that Germany and Europe could be confronted with some difficult questions. You know, we've seen some sort of previews of that in recent years with the debates in some countries, including Germany, over whether to include Huawei in the construction of critical infrastructure such as 5G networks. And there could be more of that to come. That's going to be a difficult line for Europe, but it's also going to be a tricky line for America to walk. What we saw during the Trump administration was a complete disregard in most cases for the views of allies in Europe on things like Huawei and 5G. It was a very sort of aggressive, you're with us or you're against us line, and it caused a lot of resentment in European circles. That's clearly not going to be the line that the Biden administration wants to take. But at the same time, you know, this American administration has come to office and clearly sees China as its number one foreign policy challenge, as its number one strategic competitor. And because it wants to work with and through allies, that means that Europeans are going to have to think about how they perceive China and what that means for their own relationship with the American administration. So that's going to be something that both sides of the that's going to be something that that both sides of the Atlantic Alliance are going to have to think about quite carefully. But it will be a challenge whether you had Angela Merkel remaining in office. It will be a challenge for whoever is going to be in government. I think this is more a feature of sort of the shifting tectonic plates of global geopolitics than it is for, you know, whatever particular arrangement you're going to see in the German government. So that's going to be something to watch quite carefully in the years ahead, I think.
Thank you, Tom Nuttall, for taking part in this podcast.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.